This is Polyphonic Press, the podcast where two music fans pick a classic album completely at random. Using the patented random album generator, they are given an album to review from a curated list of over 1,000 classic releases, spanning multiple genres. And now onto the show. Here are your hosts, Jeremy Boyd and John Van Dyke.
Hey, welcome to Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
I'm John Van Dyke.
And let's not waste any time. We've got the patented random album generator right in front of us here. So let's hit the button and see what album we're going to be listening to this week. And the album we're going to be listening to is Elvis Presley, Elvis Is Back.
Okay.
Okay. So let's see what the description for this album is. It says that Elvis Is Back is the 10th studio album by Elvis Presley, released on April 8th, 1960. It marked his triumphant return to the recording studio after serving 2 years in the U.S. Army. The album showcased a more mature and versatile Elvis, blending rock and roll, rhythm and blues, pop, and even jazz influence into a polished and sophisticated sound. The album features standout tracks like Fever, where Elvis delivers a sultry, stripped-down performance, and Such a Night, a lively, swaggering tune. His vocal power shines on The Girl of My Best Friend and the soulful Reconsider Baby. The album also embraces a broader stylistic range, with crooner ballads such as Soldier Boy and It Feels So Right, demonstrating his evolving artistry. Critically acclaimed, Elvis Is Back is often regarded as one of Presley's finest albums, proving that he had lost none of his charm or energy during his military service. The record was a commercial success and cemented his place as a dominant force in music as the 1960s began. Okay. All right. So yeah, so this was released April 8th, 1960. Genres are rock and roll, pop, R&B, blues, and rock. And the label is RCA Victor. And it was produced by Steve Scholes and Chet Atkins.
Oh, that's neat.
Interesting, yeah. And so there are 12 songs on the album, and it's split evenly, 6 and 6, between side one and side two. And what we like to do is, after the first side of the album is done, we take a pause and sort of talk about the album halfway through. And if you're listening along, which we do encourage you to do, you can pause at the album starts with the song Make Me Know It and ends with Thrill of Your Love, and side one ends with Thrill of Your Love. So if you want to stop at after that song, and we've linked the album in the show notes to both Spotify and Apple Music, so you can get it on your preferred streaming service. And here we go. So here is the first song on the album, called Make Me Know It. Okay, here we go. Okay, ending side one with Thrill of Your Love. Yeah, Elvis is a great singer, and these songs are all right, but I'm having a bit of a hard time really connecting with the songs.
Well, it was, I found in the early 60s, the rock and roll had sort of lost its edge in a lot of cases. I mean, there were still, you know, good artists putting out stuff that was, and Elvis was putting out, you know, like, I thought Dirty Dirty Feeling was pretty good. That was
a really good song. I did enjoy that one. Yeah.
Yeah. That one was the, I think, the highlight of this album, or this side anyway. It's got that energy that Elvis was known for when he started out in the mid-50s. But yeah, when you listen to a lot of rock and roll from, I don't know, about 19... mid 59 into 60, 61, something like that, it sort of had lost its edge. There's a few things. I guess it wouldn't really take until the Beatles to bring its edge back in a lot of ways.
I guess that's right. And you know, it really did sort of happen. Like, Al was going into the army in 57, and, you know, this is, you know, 3 years later, so they had sort of kept his career sort of going by putting out a few compilation albums, but he wasn't recording anything during those 3 years. So this is sort of him dipping his toe back. I mean, 3 years is a long time to be away from doing something like that. Like, if you really think about it, imagine not doing this podcast for 3 years and then trying to get back into it.
I think we sort of did that.
Yeah, but and so like it's sort of like I get that this is sort of his comeback after being in the army and being away for a few years, but I don't you're right, it the rock and roll of the 50s had lost its edge, and Elvis at this point, he was no longer the biggest thing in the world. And in America, I can't really, there wasn't a whole lot going on in the early 60s. And you're right, it wasn't really until 64 when the Beatles came over to America and sort of showed the Americans how to do rock and roll again.
Yeah, and then there was like that huge, just an absolute enormous deluge of rock and roll and stuff like that. And a lot of it came from, you know, England as well. I mean, the British invasion was really responsible. Not just the Beatles, but the Beatles were, you know, the forefront of that, for sure. Yeah, them and the Stones and the Kinks, and I'm thinking of a few others, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. And, you know, here, like, this the way that Elvis is singing here too, it's sort of like he's not singing with that. I mean, the song doesn't really call for it, but like that sort of that raspiness that he would sing with, like think of him singing like Hound Dog. He's not really, even on Dirty Dirty Feeling, he could have gone there, but he didn't really. And so it's sort of like, yeah, he's sort of doing the rock and roll thing, but it's not as raw, it's not as rock and roll. You
know? It's not as raw as it was.
Yeah.
No, and partly as he was getting older. I mean, he was maturing, but for, you know, more importantly, his voice was maturing. And so that's, you know, probably a reason why it didn't. And yeah, 2 or 3 years away from, you know, doing that. Yeah, it's that would be enough to sort of, you know, your voice would change in that time.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially if you're not using it. You know, and, you know, even if you are using it, it is hard to keep singing that way, 'cause it does wear on your vocal cords. You know, I did actually really enjoyed his version of Fever as well. I thought that was really well done. Very minimalist, minimal, like no instruments, just a bass and some bongo accents on the bongo drums. Yeah.
It was very, very, very minimal. Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. It's not the best version of that song that I've ever heard, but it's a pretty good version. I think Ray Charles still has, like, probably, you know, the monopoly on probably the best version, being probably, I think it's his song.
He really did bring, like, I don't even think he's necessarily the best rock and roll singer, but he was really important in making rock and roll mainstream. You know, and there's always the discussion around Elvis of whether he was whether he was appropriating black culture or if he was celebrating black culture, and if he was acting as sort of an ambassador and bringing it to sort of that music to a white audience.
That's sort of how I interpret it usually.
Yeah. Because I don't think, without Elvis, I don't think people would know who Fats Domino was.
Could be.
You know.
And I think of a whole bunch of other, like, artists that came, like rock and roll, the sound of rock and roll actually goes back to the late 40s with some of these blues musicians. I mean, they considered it blues, but it was very underground. But some of it, I mean, they even had like guitars with distortion on them and stuff like that. So, and it's mostly just because they're using cheap amps or broken amps or whatever. And you know, guitars that are, you know, Sears specials or whatever, their harmonies and K's and other stuff. This is before the Japanese stuff started to come, but
yeah. Yeah, and little amps with like low wattage, so you turn the volume up on your guitar just a little bit and it fuzzes out. You know?
That and quite often the amps were kinda janky sometimes to begin with. Sometimes they, you know, cut holes in the speaker to get a distorted sound sometimes.
And, you know, but getting back to this album, I feel like this album is more, it's more like when Elvis was recording with Sun Records, that was more raw and more, it was just him and his band, which was just like three other guys, a bass player, guitar player, and drummer. This is more put together. This is more of a big production. This is more like, this feels more like a Hollywood production. Like I get like a film soundtrack or something like that.
Yeah, and this is around the point where, you know, a lot of kids were hearing Elvis, and sort of the veil was put in front for a lot in a lot of senses, where people, you know, there was such a high production. I mean, the high production sounds good, but RCA, at least at this point, was not really. I mean, this is before, like, you know, the punk movement and stuff like that, where people were actively seeking out a raw sound. Sun Records happened to have a raw sound just because they were a tiny little studio and they were recording, you know, teenagers who came in and with their amps and guitars and drums and stuff like that, and just, like, you know, just mic them up, and you get this, you know, raw naivety sound, and you know, it's very primitive, but it's also very, it's primitive in a sophisticated kind of way. It's not overly thought out, but and this is what the Beatles sort of turned the veil that I was speaking about, the veil of like the big production and stuff like that. This is around the time Elvis was making all those movies, where he would, you know, sing in a movie and something like that, and the music was pumped in behind him. And for a lot of kids, it made it seem like, you know, being a musician was too magical to really be of something that they could do.
Yeah, this sort of vague idea in their head of, oh, so a guy playing a violin or something. That's what a musician is.
Yeah. And then when the Beatles hit. It's wrong, no. Wrong era, wrong guy.
Yeah, it's the Ed Sullivan show.
Not Dick Clark. Ed Sullivan.
Ed Sullivan, yeah.
Ed Sullivan, thank you. I did know this. Anyway, yeah, when they hit the Ed Sullivan show, the kids everywhere decided to go, or they watched it, and with awe, they went, oh, is that all it takes? You know, I can do that. I play guitar. I got some other guys that play instruments and stuff like that. We should form a band ourselves and rock out. And then, but, you know, everybody and their uncle, or everybody and their nephew, they're mostly pretty young. So decided to do that. And a huge explosion of musicians again. Yeah, I honestly believe that's what happened. But yeah, this was around the time where that veil was in place, and it just seemed so detached from reality being something you could do.
Yeah. Yeah, it's sort of like, oh, it's nice to listen to, and, you know, I'm enjoying the music.
Yeah, it's not bad. But it's, I mean, and I'm guessing, well, one of the producers is Chet Atkins.
Yeah.
Does he play on this?
No, he doesn't play on this.
Okay.
But he does. But Scotty Moore does play on this. Who is Elvis's? Like he was in Elvis's original band from the 50s.
Well, that's pretty cool that he kept the guitar player. Anyway, did any of the other musicians come along with him? Yeah.
I don't think so. I think it's just Scotty Moore.
Yeah. I wonder if that's also kind of contributed. It contributes to it. I mean, the guitar playing is great and stuff like that, but sometimes if you don't have that original sort of band atmosphere, it's hard to, you know, get that energy going again. Instead, you're just going into a studio and, you know, putting out, you know, piecing everything together, and you know, that's legit and everything like that, but, you know, it's not... It's not live off the floor. It's a very different kind of atmosphere. It gives a completely different energy.
Right. Yeah. No. I would imagine that. Like, I don't know the process of how this was recorded, but I would imagine that they would have recorded the instrumentals way before Elvis was ready to come in and sing them. Like they would have had those ready to go. It still could be live. Actually, no, it was probably live with Elvis singing with the musicians set up, but it's not, it's with the musicians with a chart in front of them. It's not like a spontaneous, let's capture the energy in the room live off the floor feeling. It's, we're just recording this song and play it how it's written out, please. Yeah.
The big studios hadn't really caught on to that idea yet of the spontaneity off the floor, and it really took some visionaries and recording techniques to actually, you know, make that distinction. And it sort of brings me back, like, in a similar kind of way, like when the Beatles were recording with George Martin. And George Martin was just a guy who used to do comedy records and stuff like that. And the Beatles, the studio didn't know what to do with the Beatles. They wanted them, but they didn't know what to do with them. Because, again, they were just a little bit outside of what they were used to. They knew they were getting big and very popular, but they didn't know what to do with them. So they sent them to see what, you know, George Martin over here can do with them. And again, right off the floor and stuff like that, and the spontaneity and the energy was just there. It really does work. I mean, you can replicate it, but if you really got to know what you're doing.
Exactly.
If you're piecing it together.
Yeah,
is what I mean.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So I did manage to find a few interesting facts about the album. So this was the first album recorded after his military service. This was Elvis's first studio album after returning from his 2-year stint in the U.S. Army, 1958-60. Fans eagerly anticipated his comeback, and the album did not disappoint. It was the first Elvis album recorded in true stereo. Unlike his earlier albums, Elvis Is Back was recorded and released in true stereo, making it a significant milestone in his discography and offering a richer listening experience. Everything else up until this point had been recorded in mono.
Yeah, I'll believe it. This was around the time when stereo was taken over. Right up into the mid to late 60s, it was still very common to find mono copies. Like, I've got that first Cream album on mono, which I prefer just because the recording of it was, the stereo recording of it was just a little bit off in some songs. But
well, in a lot of cases too, I think people still only had mono setups in their home. They didn't have a stereo, so they would still offer like a mono version of the album for that, because if you got the stereo version, you're not hearing everything. Yeah,
it sort of depends. There were some records that I've seen that say this is a stereo recording, but it can be played on mono equipment. That was a not uncommon thing written on a lot of records. But yeah, if you had a stereo, it was a much more, what's the word I'm looking for?
It would be like a more immersive experience.
Immersive experience. That's the word I was looking for. Thank you.
Yeah. That's all right. And the last one that I found is, it was the album cover was kind of controversial in the UK. So in the UK, the album initially featured an alternate cover with a close-up of Elvis in army uniform. This led to some controversy, as some felt RCA was exploiting his military service for sales. The US version had a more neutral portrait of Elvis smiling against a blue background, which is what you
That's
can see
what
here.
We're looking at right there, yeah. I mean, it's a pretty... They might be right, but I don't think that was necessarily what they were trying to do. It's a lot more controversial stuff would come along in the following years. that's pretty tame by,
yeah.
Though I'm guessing,
but for the time, I guess it was,
for the time it was a little
shocking.
What do you think you're doing?
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, there was a bit of a controversy there. So, yeah. I get it is pretty tame. It's kind of a non-issue, really.
Yeah, kind of a non-issue.
But anyway, I guess we'll get back into the second side of the album. But before we do, let's hear from our friends over at the podcast Can I Pod with Madness? So check those guys out.
Can I Pod with Madness? What we will be doing is looking through vintage Kerrang and Metal Hammer, all from late 80s.
I remember when someone lent me Somewhere in Time, and by that time I'd heard Marillion and I'd heard Def Leppard and heard Bon Jovi on the radio, and I thought I knew what heavy metal was. But when this started, I thought, I don't know if I can take this. It was so harsh, it was so metal. I thought, I think this is going to be too much for me. But I persevered. I pushed through.
Yeah.
And I think if you tell most Maiden fans would probably think this has got a soft album because it's got keyboards on it or synth guitars or something. But yeah, for me, it was a shock to the system.
I credit Alice Cooper with introducing me into type of music, because when I heard that, it was like...
Blew your mind.
Yeah, two friends over. I was like, listen to me, like, obviously this is blowing my mind, so it's going to blow your mind too, this is going to be amazing. And played it to them, and then they went, do you like heavy metal? And I was like mortified. And I've never forgotten that, because she'd been like, yes, I fucking like heavy metal, kicked over the tape player and walked out of my own room.
We'll now take a few seconds before we begin side two. Thank you. Here's side two.
All right, and ending the album with Reconsider Baby. Okay, so the second half was way better than the first half.
I think so, too.
Yeah. I don't know where all those songs were hiding in the first half, but it's they really stepped it up in the second second yeah. side.
I guess they didn't want it to end on a low note or anything like that, and they certainly didn't.
No.
Yeah, that might be one of the best songs on the album, actually.
That sax solo was amazing. Yeah. All the sort of more rock and bluesy stuff is definitely on the second side. And now I can see why this is regarded as one of the best albums, because it's like, okay, now I get it. Now I see the whole picture. And I think really what it is it's sort of more like a showcase of what, like showing off Elvis's range as a singer. Like he can, you know, sing in these different styles.
Oh, it absolutely covers a lot of bases, this album. For sure. I mean, they don't call him the king of rock and roll for nothing. He wasn't the first. He wasn't even necessarily the best, but he was so important.
Absolutely.
The debate on whether or not he was appropriating or anything like that. I mean, that was a... I don't know of another way that rock and roll would have crossed over to white audiences.
Honestly, no.
And honestly, he's just playing the music he loves.
Well, yeah. I mean, he grew up in rural Mississippi, and in very, like, his family was very poor. And he grew up, like, around, surrounded by black people, because that's just who was in those neighborhoods. And so he was exposed to like gospel music at a very early age. So he was just, to him, that was just normal. That was just, that's what music sounded like. Right. So, you know, I can see if the argument was, you know, later in life, seeing black artists and saying, okay, I'm going to make that music and intentionally try to sell it to a white audience, then maybe the argument could be made. But just the fact that he's just singing the kind of music that he likes to sing and it comes naturally to him, yeah, I don't think there's an argument there.
Yeah. I've always had a little bit of trouble with that one because, you know, who's to say what kind of music someone will fall in love with whatever kind of music that they are going to fall in love with, and they're gonna, if they're in, and if that's the direction that they want to take a career in or something like that, then it's completely unfair to sort of pigeonhole them in something, pigeonhole them into, you know, a genre based on something as arbitrary as the color of their skin.
Yeah. And, you know,
and that goes both ways.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And if you were maybe exploiting that music in a way, like I said, to make money, yeah, okay, that's pretty shitty and don't do that. But, like, you know, if you're just recording the kind of music that you love and you know, and the stuff that excites you, and, you know, you shouldn't have to cut yourself off just because of some arbitrary rule or something like that, you know. Yeah. But anyway, this, yeah, I mean, I think this the second half of the album is just, the first half was okay, but it wasn't really gripping me like the second half. And
no, same with me. I mean, there was the one song, Dirty, Dirty Feeling, that I thought was like, okay, here's a little bit of the old Elvis. But yeah, he seemed to be back in full force on the second half of the album. Yeah. So, are we at the point of the thing where we pick our three favorite songs?
Yeah, I was just going to ask. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to go with It Feels So Right, Dirty, Dirty Feeling, and Reconsider Baby.
Okay, interesting.
Those are my three favorites, I think.
All right, mine would be Yeah, Dirty Dirty Feeling, Such a Night, and Reconsider Baby.
Okay.
Those would be my...
Pretty close.
Yeah.
Such a Night was pretty good, too. But I just love that it started off so interesting, the feel so right. It was just like, I don't know. There was just a really interesting rhythm to it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's another great song.
Reconsider Absolutely. Baby with its acoustic guitar in it and stuff like that almost reminded me of what the Stones were doing on the Dirty Sticky Fingers sessions or something like that.
Yeah, like Exile on Main Street. Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree for sure. And the piano, whoever was playing the piano was doing a fantastic job on that too. So that that brings us to the question is, would you listen to this album again?
I might. Yeah, especially the second half. Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of, like, you know, the crooner stuff, but again, that was just part of his repertoire at the time and it was very popular.
Exactly.
It's not my cup of tea. I can respect it. Mm-hmm. Just like I respect, people like Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra for the stuff they do. I mean, again, not my cup of tea, but I respect it.
Yeah.
But yeah, when he starts to actually get down into the blues and stuff like that, that's absolutely, it's really, really, really good. So
yeah,
I'm going to say, yeah, I could listen to this again.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I pretty much feel the same way. I would probably listen to this again too. I can get through the crooner stuff and it's not bad. I don't hate it, but I'd rather listen to the more bluesy stuff. Yeah, I guess we'll end the episode there. Thank you so much for listening if you made it this far. If you enjoy the show, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. And we'd love it for you to leave us a rating and a review, as it really helps us, helps new listeners find us. And if you want to support the show and get some exclusive content, get these episodes the day before they go live, you can do that by going to our Patreon. Go to patreon.com/polyphonicpress. And you can also check out the website, get all the episodes that we've done so far, and plus different updates and stuff like that. Just go to polyphonicpress.com. And I think that just about does it. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
I'm John Van Dyke.
Take it easy.